Welcome to the Educator Podcast, Walking History, where we explore the history around us by actually walking it. I'm your host, Matt Douglas, former history teacher, longtime educator, and life coach for teens and young adults. This weekend, I walked the National Mall in Washington, D.C., one of the most iconic and historic spaces in America. This is Walking History, the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Walking History, where we're going to discuss the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Now, this has always been one of my favorite tourist and kind of historic destinations. I've always been a history nerd and I've loved this kind of stuff. The first time I visited the National Mall in D.C., I was probably about 10 or 12 years old. I grew up in New Jersey, so going to D.C. was, you know, a weekend kind of family trip. And I remember even then the first time being very impressed by it and just sort of in awe and excited by all the history and monuments and memorials and impressive buildings around me. And over the course of the past 20 years or so, I've been there probably 10 or 12 times. I visited in high school. I went to college very close by, and so I would go there every so often. And then in the years after college, I would visit here and there. And now I live relatively close by, so I've gotten to go. Recording for this episode and researching and then going back and visiting was a really great experience for me personally, just because it brought back a lot of those memories, but also because I got to really appreciate a lot more of what the National Mall really is, its history, what it has to offer. So I hope you take away some of that from this episode as well. So let's go ahead and get into it. Let's talk about the history and what it's like to visit the National Mall today. So for this episode, we're going to start with some interesting facts. Then we're going to talk about an overview of the entire mall, its history, and what it's like to visit there today. And then we're going to go into detail on six of the most famous monuments and memorials: the Washington Monument, the World War II Memorial, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial and Reflecting Pool, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and the Thomas Jefferson Memorial. We'll talk about their history and what it's like to visit each of those individual places today. So if you want to learn about one of those in particular, feel free to skip ahead. Otherwise, please stay tuned and just listen to this whole thing, because I think you're going to learn a whole lot. I sure did. So let's start with an overview here. The National Mall gets about 25 million visitors each year, and it's an area about 2 miles wide east to west, with the Washington Monument standing proudly at its center. Now, there are technically three different designations for this area. There's the Mall, the National Mall, and the Reserve. Now, I've always just heard it called the Mall or the National Mall, but these are actually specific and sort of different designations. The Mall is just the green space between the Washington Monument and the Capitol Building. The green open park space that most people refer to as the National Mall actually encompasses all the area from the steps of the Capitol Building in the east to the Lincoln Memorial in the west, and the entire area south, including West Potomac Park, the Tidal Basin, and the area around the Jefferson Memorial. The designation of the Reserve adds to that the Capitol Building itself and all the green space from the Washington Monument north to the White House, including the White House itself. Now, for this episode, when we talk about the area, we're just going to refer to the whole thing as the National Mall. So the area stands as the city's center of recreation and tourism, but it's really also a monument to American history and culture and democracy itself. And the National Mall itself has been home to the making of history, as it's really the heart and primary symbol of political activism in the United States. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech there in 1963 in front of a crowd of an estimated 250,000 people. Pope John Paul II gave Mass there in 1979. And quite sadly, on January 6, 2021, a rally supporting President Donald Trump, which began there, ended when hundreds of protesters stormed the U.S. Capitol, leading to the immediate deaths of one rioter and one police officer, and ultimately hundreds of arrests. Now, the National Mall is truly a monument to the living history of the United States, And just as it's been used to remember and appreciate the American past, so too has it remained a place of relaxation and enjoyment for the public and tourists alike for almost two centuries. It really is like an American icon. So let's talk about the history of the National Mall, and then we'll get into what it's like to visit it today. But real quick, first, let's talk about some of those interesting facts. So, number one, the word mall comes from the Mall of London, which in the 1700s was a promenade near Buckingham Palace in London where the wealthy would go to spend their day outside. Number two, much of the area of the current National Mall was once actually underwater and was only fully filled in the late 1800s. Number three, the Washington Monument was for a time the tallest structure in the world until it was surpassed by the building of the Eiffel Tower in 1889. Number four, in 2011, a 5.8 magnitude earthquake struck the area, which I was there for. If you were there, you probably remember this. And it caused cracks in the Washington Monument, which left it closed for repairs for years. And lastly, number five, a canal used to run through much of the National Mall, and the oldest building remaining on the mall today is the Canal Lawkeeper's House, located just northwest of the Washington Monument. So, let's get into the history and talk about the timeline of the events leading from its creation to where we are today. So, the very beginning of the National Mall, I would say, begins on July 16th, 1790, when Congress declared that D.C. would be the capital of the United States. In 1791, President George Washington sort of proclaimed the same thing, really making it official. And in that year, 1791, President George Washington commissioned French engineer Pierre L'Enfant to develop a plan for the district, especially its government buildings and open space. Now, if you go to D.C. today, it really feels like a planned city. The way the streets are laid out, the way those circles are kind of laid out, the open spaces, the government buildings. L'Enfant designed most of this, and it really is a testament to the ability to plan out a city when you have the chance to do that. You know, compare Washington, D.C. to any of the European capitals, which for the most part seems sort of haphazardly put together. Washington, D.C. really was a planned city from the beginning. L'Enfant imagined a wide tree-lined avenue home to embassies and important buildings that would become what we know today as the National Mall. And although many of the specifics of his plan did not actually come to be, his general outline really remained the cornerstone for the building of the mall, and you can see much of his influence when you go there today. For example, he was the one who placed the White House and Capitol building where they are, the locations of them, at the opposite ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, which, incidentally, was named by Thomas Jefferson. And at the time, that road, Pennsylvania Avenue, was the main downtown road of this new city. On October 13th at noon on 1792, the cornerstone of the White House was laid, and the next year in 1793, President George Washington laid the cornerstone of what would become the Capitol building. Now, at the time, the area looked much different than it does today. Much of the area, particularly what would become the National Mall itself, was either part of a large floodplain of the Potomac River, or it didn't even exist at all. It was actually made up of water. At the time, a large stream known as the Tiber Creek, also known as Goose or Tuber Creek, opened wide as it reached the Potomac River and roughly followed just to the south of modern-day Pennsylvania Avenue. The Washington Monument actually jutted out kind of like on a peninsula where the Tiber Creek and the Potomac met, and all the area south and west of the Washington Monument did not exist. It was all part of the Potomac River. So really the only part that even existed was kind of this jut of land where the Washington Monument was, and then the area east to the Capitol building, and then north, although you had to cross over the Tiber Creek, to the White House. By 1800, the White House was completed, and in 1829, the Capitol building was finished. Throughout the early to mid-1800s, that Tiber Creek was filled in, creating all the open space that can be seen today between the Washington Monument and the Capitol building, as well as the White House. The city slowly grows around this area. In 1847, construction of the Smithsonian Castle begins, which was finished in 1855. In 1848, construction began on the Washington Monument, which was created just slightly off-center to the right at a right angle between where the White House and Capitol building would be. If you look at it on a map, they kind of create a right angle. And it was not finished until 1884, almost 40 years later. In 1875, the Army Corps of Engineers proposed to dredge the Potomac River to allow for easier shipping access and to use all that silty material taken from it to fill in the area west of the Washington Monument, creating much of what will become the remainder of the National Mall as we know it today, as well as the famous Tidal Basin. So that's where all that land came from, silt dredged from the Potomac River. The work was finished in the 1880s. Now, throughout this time, the National Mall wasn't nearly the centerpiece of Washington, D.C., and the beautiful open tourist park that it is today. A canal ran through much of it, it was filled mostly with trees and gardens, and a variety of older buildings and even railroad tracks could be found throughout. Really, if you had visited there, you know, sometime in the early to mid-1800s, you just would have seen the White House, the Capitol Building, the Washington Monument, a handful of buildings and museums, and green space, but mostly sort of forested, gardened area. Definitely a place for recreation, but not nearly the place that it is today. Now, that all really starts to change in 1902, when the Senate commissioned the McMillan Plan, which reimagined the National Mall to become the centerpiece of the city, and a vast, open, memorial-filled public park. So when we think of the National Mall, it's really what happens in the 1900s that turns it into what we know it as today. Dozens of buildings, museums, art galleries, and gardens pop up in and around the National Mall, many of them world-renowned, including, for example, the Museum of Natural History, the Hirshhorn Museum, the National Gallery of Art Buildings, the Air and Space Museum, and the Holocaust Museum, and then important recent additions like the National Museums of the American Indian and African American History. In 1912, the famous cherry trees are planted, which we'll talk about a bit later. In 1922, the Lincoln Memorial and Reflecting Pool are built. In 1943, the Jefferson Memorial is built. In 1982, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is built. In 2004, the World War II Memorial is built. And in 2011, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial is built. And you can kind of imagine through the years, through the decades, more and more of these memorials and monuments pop up and green spaces added, and it kind of just grows and grows to become what we know it today. So visiting it today really is quite an experience. And I have to say, if your goal is to visit every monument and every museum and all the political buildings in the area, be prepared to spend the better part of a week there. There is so much to do. Lots of events are held there, including concerts, all kinds of political rallies and marches, the world-famous Cherry Blossom Festival, presidential inauguration ceremonies, which typically host hundreds of thousands of supporters. Mostly, though, for most people who are going to go to the National Mall, especially on a daily basis or as a tourist, it's really just a place for locals and people visiting to just use it for activities and relaxation and to be outside and enjoy this beautiful space. So what's it like to visit today? Let's paint the picture. I want you to kind of close your eyes and imagine that you're in the center of the National Mall with the Washington Monument towering above you. All around you, you see hundreds, if not thousands, of people picnicking or exercising, playing sports, just spending time being outdoors. And then due east to your right, due north in front of you, due left to the west, and then south, there's all these different sort of sections and areas of the mall that kind of give it the character that it has. So let's start to the right, due east. Due east, you're going to see dozens of food trucks of every type, and then beyond them, a mile-long stretch of open grass lined by the famous elm trees which were planted there in the 1930s, which ends all the way down at the steps of the U.S. Capitol building. On either side of this wide lawn are some of the most famous museums in the world, most of them free, which makes it even better, including some which we mentioned before, the Holocaust Museum, the Museum of African American History, the Smithsonian Castle, the Hirshhorn Museum, the Museum of Natural History, the Air and Space Museum, the National Gallery of Art, the Sculpture Garden, and the Museum of the American Indian, just to name a few. If you're going down that area, you can spend, you know, literally a few days popping into all those museums. They are fabulous. I've been into most of them over the years, and you really kind of can't get enough. They're great places for kids. They're great places for just to visit for the day. I love this. There's actually an authentic working carousel sitting in the grounds right there that you can still ride. And then as you continue to walk, you finally end at the Capitol building. When I was a kid and I visited, you could actually walk all the way up the Capitol steps, but that was closed off many years ago for security concerns. And now, as you can probably imagine, security is even tighter after the January 6th insurrection. You can see fences, there's certainly lots of security, and you sort of realize you're in an area where you're not quite supposed to be. You're not supposed to get too close to the Capitol or any of these important buildings. There's going to be police presence there to stop you from doing that. Just beyond is the Supreme Court building and the Library of Congress, although those two buildings are not technically part of the National Mall. Now let's go back to the Washington Monument. If you're standing there and you look due north, about a half mile ahead sits the White House. Police and Secret Service agents patrol the entire area, but you can still walk north across Constitution Avenue, past the open green space known as the Ellipse, to the edge of the White House lawn, where obviously security is quite strong, but you can really see the White House and the whole ground around it, and it is quite impressive. To the west of the Washington Monument lies one of the most iconic American vistas, the World War II Memorial leading into the reflecting pool, and just beyond that, on top of a small hill, the massive and stunningly impressive Lincoln Memorial. Just north of the Lincoln Memorial, tucked away in the trees, lies the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and just south of it lies the Korean Veterans Memorial. South of the Washington Monument is the Great Tidal Basin. It's like a huge lake extending from the Potomac River, and that lake is surrounded by over 3,000 Japanese cherry trees, donated by Japan in 1912, and then it is home to the spectacular Cherry Blossom Festival, which is attended by about 1.5 million visitors annually and takes place every year in early spring during the few short weeks when the trees bloom. I've been there for it. It is really spectacular. It is very, very crowded. So if you're going to go, make sure you plan your trip and give yourself lots of time to be there. But it's something really special about being on the edge of basically a lake with these beautiful memorials around you and thousands of fully blossomed, fully blooming cherry trees. It really is quite an experience to go. If you can make it there, I highly recommend it. The edges of the Tidal Basin are home to three more memorials, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, the FDR Memorial, and located due south of the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial. Now, the Tidal Basin is a really cool place to spend some time just there itself. Most people, when they go to the National Mall, they kind of avoid it. They stick with the Washington Monument or the museums or the Lincoln Memorial. But if you have the time to go down, it's a great place to spend part of an afternoon. You can actually rent paddle boats on the Tidal Basin. And when I was there over the weekend, I saw people fishing on the Tidal Basin. There were some signs saying that you couldn't, but maybe that was just one area. So I don't quite know, but there were a few people there. They were clearly having a great time. Now, if you want to visit, some important things to know. Parking and driving into the National Mall area is extremely difficult. Don't say I didn't warn you. Parking is very limited. So there aren't very many parking lots, and the ones that there are get crowded extremely quickly. I went to one parking lot and had to circle around three times before I could finally find a place to park. If you're able to get a place to park, good for you. It's about $2.50 an hour to park there. When I was there, there was a three-hour long time limit. Driving into the area, though, is more difficult. There are no signs anywhere. Driving anywhere in and around D.C., especially on the Potomac River on the D.C. side or the Virginia side, is a nightmare. There are no signs. You're kind of taking your life into your own hand. Even if you're local, I mean, I don't know how you do it. I've been to D.C. many, many times, and I still just can't understand. You miss a random exit, and suddenly you're over a bridge in Virginia. There's tons of roads closed. There's traffic. There's pedestrians all over the place. I'm sure you're going to ignore this, but don't say I didn't warn you. In my opinion, the best options to get to the National Mall are to either park at least a few blocks away and just walk, or take the Metro in. The Metro is phenomenal. There's a bunch of stops right near the National Mall. Or just take an Uber and get dropped off. Make your life that much easier. So my experience when I went this weekend, like I said, driving and parking was pretty harrowing, pretty nuts. But, you know, I made it there one piece, so no big deal. But if you can avoid it, try to. So as you listen on, I'm going to take you guys basically on a tour of the National Mall, mostly to the west and the south of the Washington Monument, where most of those famous monuments and memorials are. We're not really going to be talking much about the White House or those museums. Instead, we're going to talk about the history and what it's like to visit today, that open space, those memorials, those really famous monuments. Now, if you have a map in front of you, or if you can visualize this in your head, we're going to start at the Washington Monument. We're going to walk west to the World War II Memorial, just past the Lockkeeper's House and the Constitution Gardens, up to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, then down to the Lincoln Memorial and the Reflecting Pool, and then southeast through the Korean Memorial to the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, around the Tidal Basin, past those cherry trees, through the FDR Memorial and the George Mason Historical Marker, all the way to the Jefferson Memorial, and then back up to the Washington Monument. Now, I took this walk over the weekend. It took me about 3 hours, but you could easily spend double that amount of time, especially if you want to sit and relax or eat or visit some of the museums and gift shops that are there along the way. I have a step counter on my phone, and it recorded me walking 5 miles. That sounds about right. So not for the faint of heart if you're going to really be spending the whole day walking. You know, you can really just park and enjoy one or two of these memorials, and that can be your whole day. There's so much to do. It's so amazing. It's so well done. Like I said, we're going to talk about 6 of these locations in detail, their history, and then what it's like to visit today. So feel free to skip ahead if you want to go right to one of these. We'll start with the Washington Monument. Then we'll talk about the World War II Memorial, then the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial and Reflecting Pool, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and then finally the Jefferson Memorial. Now, just one quick note. In general, I was surprised by this. There are very few interpretive signs or historical markers in the area. I was kind of shocked. You kind of got to look things up on your phone or bring a map or a tour guide or a tour book or listen to something like this. So I hope you get a lot out of this, and let this episode of Walking History be your guide to the National Mall in Washington, D.C. So we start with the Washington Monument, which is an obelisk 555 feet tall, made of marble, granite, and bluestone gneiss, built to commemorate President George Washington. The monument is a 500-foot-tall hollow obelisk, 55 feet wide at its base and 34.5 feet wide at the top, so it kind of converges at the top a bit, capped with a 55-foot-tall pyramid. It is the world's tallest obelisk and was the tallest building in the world when it was completed, until it was overtaken by the construction of the Eiffel Tower in 1889. Its construction began in 1848 and was finally finished in 1884, with additional interior and cosmetic work finished in 1888. The Washington Monument kind of is a story of the struggle of trying to finish something as big and impressive and literally as monumental as this. So let's talk a bit about the history before we talk about what it's like to kind of visit there today. So a monument for George Washington was first conceived by Pierre L'Enfant in his original plans for D.C., and he actually reserved the space where it now resides on the intersecting lines due south of the White House and due west of the Capitol building. In 1833, the Washington National Monument Society, a private organization, was formed to fund and build this monument. They solicited donations and designs for about a decade, and that year, 1833, was the 100th anniversary of George Washington's birth. So they started collecting donations, and by the middle of the 1830s, they had raised over $28,000 and had announced a competition for a design of the memorial. Now, that $28,000 was not nearly enough to finish it. They knew that. The idea was that once you started to build it and kind of gain some traction and some excitement in the country, donations would start to pour in. Not quite what happens, and we'll talk about that as the story goes on here. So in 1845, they settled on a design by Robert Mills, and Robert Mills' original design called for a 600-foot Egyptian-style obelisk instead of the 555-foot one that we have today, ringed by 3,100-foot columns at the base. These obviously did not make it to the final design. In 1848, despite difficulty raising these funds, construction began. The cornerstone was laid on July 4th, with about 20,000 people in attendance, including then-President James K. Polk, Mrs. James Madison, Mrs. Alexander Hamilton, and future Presidents Buchanan, Lincoln, and Johnson, all in attendance. Builders at that time began work on the Blue Gneiss Foundation, using stone from a quarry near Baltimore. In 1853, a new group aligned with the controversial Know-Nothing Party gained control of the board of the Washington National Monument Society, and having always sort of struggled to gain funding anyway, the society's change in administration alienates lots of donors. If you know anything about early American history in the 1800s, the Know-Nothing Party was sort of like a racist, xenophobic party, and it kind of killed all work on the monument right around then. A year later, for example, in 1854, the society is driven to bankruptcy for lack of funding. Now, at this point, about 10 years into the project here, the monument had reached a height of 156 feet, but the construction was stopped, and a year later, in 1855, the architect Robert Mills dies. So in 1855, you have a partially completed monument sitting on the National Mall, and it isn't revived for decades. Part of the reason why is because the sectional tension leading up to the Civil War, and then the Civil War itself halts that construction. And by the 1870s or so, it's really become an embarrassment as opposed to a monument for this very, very important man. On July 5th, 1876, Congress decides to assume the duties of funding and building of the monument, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, led by Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Casey, is responsible for directing and then completing the work. His first task is to strengthen the foundation of the monument, and for 4 years, the workers work on that. Now, what's interesting is because so much time had gone by, the Baltimore quarry where they had gotten their stone was no longer operational. So they end up going to a quarry in Massachusetts to get their stone. The color, and you can see this today, was actually slightly different. There's a small line about a third of the way up, which is like a light brown streak when they used a new set of stone. And then they again choose a different set of stone from a different quarry, and that new set of stone is used for the upper two-thirds of the structure. So the stone never really matches exactly. You don't quite notice unless you're looking for it, but you can definitely tell when you're there. That plan for those ring columns around the obelisk is scrapped, and the height of the obelisk is now changed to a total height of 550 feet high. On December 6th, 1884, Casey supervised as the 3,300-pound capstone was brought out through one of the windows of the Washington Monument and hoisted to the top of it and set in place. I'm just imagining this 3,000-pound stone capstone being brought up on pulleys and winches in the 1800s and everybody just hoping to God it doesn't fall. But it made it up there. And then Casey places an almost 9-inch aluminum tip to top the capstone to the cheers of the crowd below. Now you wonder why aluminum? Well, at the time, aluminum was extremely rare and just about as expensive as silver. On February 21st, 1885, one day before Washington's birthday, which had fallen on a Sunday that year, the Washington Monument is finally dedicated. In 1886, the monument is first accessible to the public, and there's a staircase that goes to the top. In 1888, there's a public elevator, which is steam-driven, and it takes about 10 to 12 minutes to reach the top. You can imagine sitting in an elevator for 10 to 12 minutes to get up to the top of this monument. Not for the faint of heart, especially if you're claustrophobic at all. But in 1901, an electric elevator is installed. Now, not too much happens with the Washington Monument until over 100 years later, on August 23rd, 2011, when a 5.8 magnitude earthquake hits Virginia and the Washington, D.C. area, sustaining much damage to the Washington Monument as over 150 cracks were found. Luckily for the monument, it was only closed for a few years and reopened with really only cosmetic damage that you can't even see today. Now, if you go and visit today, you really get a sense of awe as you arrive. You may have driven past D.C. and sort of seen the Washington Monument in the distance. It kind of is like almost like the Statue of Liberty in New York. It's a marker of here you're in Washington, D.C., and it's a marker to Washington and democracy. But the closer you get, the more impressive it is. And it's on this wide open lawn atop this slight ridge of a hill. And around the monument, there is this stone patio with dozens of American flags. And as you walk up, you just realize how tall and how massive this thing is. There's a bandstand nearby. The food trucks are right there. There's usually hundreds of people milling around, playing, talking, picnicking, whatever. It's really an experience to be there, and I certainly recommend that you go if you can. From the base of it, you don't even have to go all the way to the top. Even from the base, you have clear lines of sight east to the Capitol building, north to the White House, west past the World War II Memorial, Reflecting Pool, and Lincoln Memorial. And you can clearly see all of this when you're there. It really is the centerpiece of the National Mall. Now, if you want to go up the top, you are able to, although when I was there, it was closed. I'll talk about that in just a second. But as you make your ascent, if you go up the elevator, you can view commemorative stones from various individuals and civic groups and cities and states and different countries around the world that are inset in the walls. And there are 193 of these commemorative stones. Now, when I visited, this is during COVID, it was closed and you couldn't get in. Now, I don't actually think it was closed due to COVID. It might actually have been closed due to additional security after the Capitol insurrection. Typically, even during COVID, you are able to go up. You can get tickets at recreation.gov, and they cost $1 per person, but you have to buy them the day before. Tickets go on sale at 10 a.m., and you can buy up to 4 tickets for 4 people. Now, typically, the Washington Monument is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and in the summer, it's open until 9 p.m., and it's only closed on July 4th, Christmas, and in bad weather. Now, if you can't visit, if you can't go there or it's closed, there's actually this cool plaque that tells you about an app you can get called the Time Looper app, which allows you to see the view from the top of the Washington Monument when you connect your phone to a virtual reality headset. So if you happen to have a virtual reality headset and you want to take a look at what it's like to visit the top, feel free to get that app and check it out. So a beautiful memorial, a beautiful monument to Washington, and really right in the center, the real heart of the National Mall. Now, from there, it's only a very short walk to the World War II Memorial, which is due west of the Washington Monument. So let's talk about that now. The World War II Memorial is a walkable, elliptical, gray stone plaza over 300 feet wide, ringed by pillars and quotes commemorating and explaining World War II, centered around a wide open pool with fountains. There are 56 pillars representing the U.S. states and territories surrounding the plaza, and at each end, large triumphal arches, one for each theater of war, sit crowned by sculptures of 4 eagles working together to carry a victory wreath. Definitely impressive sight, slightly understated, especially when you compare it to all the giant memorials and monuments nearby, but worthy of visiting for sure. In May of 1993, its creation was authorized by President Bill Clinton, and its designer, Friedrich St. Florian, wins a national open competition for the design. The memorial is constructed between 2001 and 2004 around that pool, which was already there. Sort of starts a bit of a controversy, but if you go there today, that pool with all these fountains and water jets coming out had already been there before the memorial was made. On April 29th, 2004, it's open to the public, and on May 29th, 2004, it is officially dedicated. Now, if you go there today, it's a really nice experience. It's not the kind of overwhelming, solemn experience you might have at other war memorials. It's kind of an expression of the country coming together as a whole and almost like a history of the war itself. Now, me being a huge history nerd, I kind of love this. I love learning about World War II, so there's a lot of interesting kind of history as part of it. So for me, I get a lot of that out of that. But a lot of people just like to go visit to go to the fountain and kind of hang out there and see the water and kind of kids play on the edge of the water. And it's a nice place to spend maybe 10 or 20 or 30 minutes going there. So when you go, if you're coming from the Washington Monument, you cross over a road and then you walk down this stone ramp past on either side of you bronze reliefs depicting images, many based off famous photographs from World War II. Now, it opens in front of you to that big pool, and when you walk to the right, to the north, it takes you to the side commemorating and depicting the European Theater, and you walk to the left, the south, it takes you to the side commemorating the Pacific Theater, and there's that open pavilion and pool in front. There are quotes by FDR, Eisenhower, George Marshall, Truman, MacArthur, Nimitz, all these sort of famous figures and faces etched throughout the memorial, and they discuss battles, words to troops, the role of women and citizens at home, all these different parts of the war. It's almost kind of like flipping through a textbook of World War II as you're visiting the memorial. So let's kind of walk through it. If you walk down that ramp and to the right, you go to the European Theater. And on the far edge there, you're going to see large quotes by Eisenhower and George Marshall, and then a little fountain with some etchings describing some of the famous battles of World War II in the European Theater. I love a couple of these quotes, so I'm going to read them. The George C. Marshall quote says, quote, "We are determined that before the sun sets on this terrible struggle, our flag will be recognized throughout the world as a symbol of freedom on the one hand and of overwhelming force on the other." I think that very well describes the attitude of the United States going into World War II. And then the second quote by General Dwight D. Eisenhower is his famous D-Day quote, where he says, quote, to his troops, "You are about to embark upon the great crusade towards which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle." And then you have those carvings underneath of the major engagements in order, chronologically, from left to right. So it starts with the Battle of the Atlantic on the left and then goes all the way through some of those famous engagements, all the way to Germany, the final stop in the Eastern Theater. On the left side, the southern side, you have quotes and descriptions of the Pacific Theater. There's quotes by Walter Lord Arthur about the Battle of Midway, and one of my favorite quotes by General Douglas MacArthur, his Wars End quote, which says, quote, "Today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world is quietly at peace." Love that quote. I think they did a very good job choosing what would go here in the memorial. Now, in the middle of the memorial, on the far side just between these two, is the Price of Freedom Wall. There are 4,048 gold stars, each representing 100 dead or missing from the war. And then above and around this whole main pavilion, accessible by ramps that go up and around each side, are the 56 pillars for all the U.S. states and territories. Now, for the life of me, I could not figure out the reasoning for the order until I finally looked it up. And the pillars are arranged in order of entry to the Union, but alternating sides north to south, north to south, north to south. In the middle, you have each of those large triumphal arches, like we had said, one for the European Theater and one for the Pacific Theater, topped by those massive sculptures of four eagles carrying a victory wreath. Now, a little bit of a Where's Waldo hunt for you guys to do if you go there. In two places, I won't tell you where, there are carvings that say Kilroy was here, engraved in some of the stone. Now, if you know anything about World War II history, their inclusion kind of acknowledges the significance of this kind of important symbol during World War II for American soldiers, as it represents that the Americans were kind of coming, the Americans were there. So take a look out for where those are. Now, like I said, it's just as much a history lesson, really, as it is a memorial. For me personally, I love that about the memorial. That had gotten some criticism when it was first built, but it's really an enjoyable experience. It gives you a sense of the country coming together to fight and to win as one nation against a very powerful set of enemies in difficult circumstances. So the memorial honors the war and the nation as much, if not more than, it honors any individual soldiers who might have fought. Now, from that spot, you can stand on the edge of the reflecting pool and look all the way down the reflecting pool to the Lincoln Memorial. It's a beautiful, beautiful sight, beautiful view. And if you turn around, you see the Washington Monument, and then far in the distance, the Capitol Building. The sight lines in the whole National Mall are really pretty phenomenal. So now we're going to walk due west and a little bit north to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Now, as you're walking north and then you turn west to go to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, you're going to pass that Canal Lawkeeper's house. Keep an eye out for that. That is the oldest building still in the National Mall today. And then you're going to pass this small lake, which is part of the Constitution Gardens. There are some benches around. It's a nice place to kind of hang out for a bit. And there's an island in the middle of the lake with a memorial to the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence sitting on it. So if you have some extra time, want to check that out, feel free. It's right on the way to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. So as you make your way past that, you're going to see some slight rises and ridges of hills, and it's a bit of a forested area, And tucked away in that area is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Now, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is a solemn and quite literally reflective memorial commemorating the 58,318 men and women who were killed or missing in action from the Vietnam War. It is V-shaped and built into the earth, with two highly polished reflective black stone walls extending almost 250 feet from the center, carved with the names of those killed and missing. Its power comes from its simplicity, as the viewer enters from either end at ground level and slowly descends to the center of the memorial. The wall begins only about an inch high, and as the viewer walks down, the walls grow to over 10 feet in height, immersing the viewer in the names of those lost and, unmistakably, their own reflection. To me, this is one of the most powerful memorials I've ever seen. I'm a huge fan of it. It was very controversial when it was first built. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But this is really a can't miss. You have to go there to just experience and reflect literally on what happened during the Vietnam War. So let's talk about its genesis and its history. So the idea for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial actually began when Vietnam vet Jan Scruggs saw the movie Deer Hunter and decided that a memorial needed to be built to honor their service. So on April 27th, 1979, 4 years after the end of the Vietnam War, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund is created, with Scruggs as its founder and his advocacy being instrumental to its creation. On July 1st, 1980, Congress authorized the site, 2 acres in size, just north of the Lincoln Memorial, where a World War I munitions building had previously stood, and announced an open design competition for its construction with a prize of $20,000. By March 30th, 1981, 1,421 designs had been submitted, and they were displayed at an airport hangar at Andrews Air Force Base, with just a number next to each design, no names. This was to be completely anonymous. The jury eventually selects entry number 1,026 by Maya Lin, an undergraduate student at Yale University. Now, its selection received immediate controversy. And looking back, it's almost like unbelievable that this happened. But the memorial, if you go there today, is very different and very unconventional than memorials that had been built in the past. So it wasn't a typical memorial where you think of either a monument to service or statues of people. It was meant to be artistic and solemn and deep. There was also a lot of criticism on Lin's lack of professional experience. She was just a college student. At least that's what many of her detractors would say. It got so bad that influential early backers of the project, including H. Ross Perot, withdrew their support. Said another early supporter, James Webb, quote, "I never in my wildest dreams imagined such a nihilistic slab of stone." He really came to eat his words. The Secretary of Interior at the time even initially refused to issue a building permit, although that was later rescinded. Now, these detractors, as really often happens with groundbreaking works of art, likely later regretted what they said and their deeds. Says Jan Scruggs later, "It, quote, has become something of a shrine." And a shrine indeed. It is a phenomenal memorial. It is a phenomenal place to visit and just experience the horrors of this war. Due to the negative reactions to the work, a compromise was finally reached, and it was agreed that a more traditional sculpture known as the Three Soldiers statue would be placed near the site, and you can view it there today. On March 11th, 1982, the revised design was formally approved, and on March 26th, 1982, ground was formally broken. The stone was quarried in India, cut and fabricated in Vermont, and then sent to Tennessee to be etched with the names. On November 11th, 1982, the memorial was dedicated during a 5-day ceremony presided over by President Ronald Reagan and tens of thousands of Vietnam veterans, accompanied by a 56-hour reading at Washington National Cathedral of all the engraved names of the dead and missing. The dedication was finished on November 13th. In 1984, the Three Soldiers statue was dedicated. In 1993, a women's memorial was built. And in 2004, an in-memory plaque honoring the men and women who later died as a result of their service in Vietnam was placed there. So what's it like to visit there? Well, like I said, it's really a visceral experience. And for me personally, it's probably the most profound and moving memorial that I've ever been to. For me, the genius is its simplicity. as you're immersed in those who lost their lives in the war, and you can't help but look at your own reflection as you read the names on the walls. Flowers, flags, notes, artifacts are left behind on the ground below the names. It's extremely powerful. The 58,318 names are listed in order of their deaths from 1959 to 1975, starting at the top right panel in the center of the memorial and wrapping all the way around in order to the right, to the far end of the memorial, and then back around on the left side, back to the middle, so that the first name, Dale R. Buis, lines up with the last name, Richard Vandegeer, a solemn reminder that each was part of the same deadly war. Those declared dead are marked by a diamond. There's a little diamond right next to their name. Those missing in action are marked by a cross. And if the person currently marked as missing in action returns alive, a circle is placed around the cross. If his remains are identified, a diamond is superimposed over the cross. Now, there are two ways to search for names. There's the traditional way, and in this age of technology, there's the new way. On the west end of the memorial, there are a few reference books, and these reference books contain all the names on the wall, their branch of service, their rank, their casualty date, the state they were from, and the panel number that they are located on. On the east end of the memorial, there's a sign showing this new technological addition, the Wall Mobile Tour app, which allows you to search for the names and their locations on your phone and can be downloaded by visiting the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund website, vvmf.org. Now, I mentioned that there's often items left at the memorial, flags, keepsakes, flowers. These items are then collected by the National Park Service and transferred to the National Park Service Museum Resource Center, which catalogs and stores all these items except for perishable organic matter like fresh flowers. Now, that main area really is the Veterans Memorial, but off to the side, you can see that Three Soldiers statue and also the Women's Memorial as well. And then if you walk south, it will take you to the Reflecting Pool and Lincoln Memorial. So let's stop there next. So as you walk south from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, you open up in sort of this wide area where you see in front of you the massive Lincoln Memorial, as well as the Reflecting Pool sitting in the distance. Now, right there, if you're coming from directly from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, I would be very remiss if I didn't mention this, but there is a stand run by the Rolling Thunder Washington, D.C. Inc. group. It has been there for 40 years. It is open 24/7. It sells all kinds of service member pins and patches, and all the proceeds and all the donations go to supporting American POWs of war. I stopped there. I talked to the guy who was running it. He was a veteran, and it just sort of part of the history at this point of the National Mall itself, and I absolutely encourage you to stop by. Give some money if you can, if you're able. It goes to, obviously, a very, very good cause. So right past there, you're going to see very prominently displayed the Lincoln Memorial and the Reflecting Pool sitting in front of it. Now, the Lincoln Memorial is a magnificent, large, white stone structure, almost 200 feet wide and 99 feet tall, built in the style of a classical Greek temple, built on top of a slight hill directly in front of the 167-foot-wide and over 2,000-foot-long Reflecting Pool. It is surrounded by 36 massive Doric-style columns, and in front of the main steps, a huge opening gives entrance to a wide-open interior. A 60-foot-tall statue of Abraham Lincoln, sitting and staring forward, sits in the middle, with two additional chamber spaces to the left and right, separated by 50-foot-high columns. In each chamber, a floor-to-ceiling inscription is carved into the wall. In the left chamber is his Gettysburg Address, and in the right, his second inaugural address. There's also a museum dedicated to activism at the Lincoln Memorial in the basement. So there have been calls to establish a memorial for Lincoln basically from the moment that he was killed. But finally, in 1910, Congress passes a law to incorporate a new memorial commission, and soon after, the Lincoln Memorial Commission meets with then-President William H. Taft as the commission's president. In 1913, Congress approves the commission's choice of design and location, and on February 12, 1914, there's a dedication ceremony, and construction begins a month later. Now, minor changes are made during the construction, but for the most part, it is very, very accurate to the original design that was put forth. The one real major change is that the Lincoln statue was originally supposed to be only 10 feet tall, but it's enlarged to 19 feet tall, just about double the size, because the room, the interior, if you go there, you see it, is just so massive that a smaller statue wouldn't really seem to fit. On May 30th, 1922, the work is complete and the memorial is dedicated. Lincoln's only surviving son, the then 78-year-old Robert Todd Lincoln, was there. And then a year later, in 1923, the reflecting pool was completed. Now, the work pretty much stays as it is until in 1994. That small museum exhibit opens underneath the Lincoln Memorial, which is dedicated, like we said, to sort of his actions and activism that takes place throughout the decades in and around the Lincoln Memorial. Definitely recommend you stop in and check it out. Pretty cool story about how it was created. Won't go too into it, but basically a bunch of kids raised money using Lincoln pennies to fund part of the site. Now, the Lincoln Memorial is an absolutely beautiful work, and it's one of my personal favorite structures and incredibly impressive. There's wide open steps with a giant reflective chamber and this huge statue of a resolute Lincoln looking determined and compassionate sitting in there. The statue is incredibly well done. It looks just like him. And then as you're walking into the left and then to the right, you see these giant floor-to-ceiling inscriptions of the Gettysburg Address and his second inaugural address, and they are beautiful. I think they're stunning. I've always personally wondered why the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't included there, but those are the words they chose to put. The ceilings in there are massive. It almost feels like a church to democracy. And you can walk around the outside of the entire building. So from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, these famous steps, I mean, think about the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech. You think of the Forrest Gump movie with Jenny running in the reflecting pool. I love that moment. But so many famous, cultural, important, iconic moments have taken place on the Lincoln Memorial or on the steps of the memorial or around the reflecting pool. It's sort of just that spot is just part of American history. Now, you can also walk around the back of the Lincoln Memorial, which I think is very interesting. Not many people go in the back, I think, but if you go, I encourage you to take a look there. You sort of walk on these giant, massive stone slabs underneath these huge pillars. It feels pretty overwhelming and impressive. And from the back, it overlooks the Potomac River. Now, I'm not sure if this was intentional, but I have to think it might have been. From that spot in the back of the Lincoln Memorial, you can see directly across the Potomac River to Arlington Cemetery. Now, Arlington Cemetery, that property, including the very large house on the hill above the cemetery, was Confederate General Robert E. Lee's mansion and property before the Civil War. It was taken and confiscated by the Union Army during the war and then turned into Arlington National Cemetery. So sort of history talking to itself. Now, once you're finished with the Lincoln Memorial, you can walk southeast past the Korean Veterans Memorial to the Tidal Basin, where you will find the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. Now, we're not going to talk too much about the Korean Veterans Memorial. Worth checking out, but definitely not one of the more impressive and well-known memorials on the National Mall. So you walk about a mile, maybe a little bit less, from the Lincoln Memorial down past some of the main roads across the National Mall to the Tidal Basin where the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial is. As you walk down, you pass some ball fields, which is pretty cool. But if you enter this side of the Martin Luther King Memorial, you're entering kind of from the back end with the Tidal Basin in front of you. Now, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial is a set of three separate 30-foot-high blocks of stone that, when put together, are intended to look like a mountain. The middle block sits removed, and the left and right stones, the left and right sides of the mountain, mark the entrance to the site, where the open area of the missing third block creates a large opening and the entrance to the memorial. The third stone, set far ahead of the other two, has a massive and imposing statue of Martin Luther King Jr. carved out of the front of the rock and is set standing with his arms folded, looking out towards the open tidal basin in front of him. On either side, a 450-foot-long crescent-shaped wall is carved with 14 inscriptions of some of Martin Luther King's most famous and influential quotes. And this is one of the newest memorials on the site. It was built quite recently. In 1996, Congress authorized Alpha Phi Alpha, Martin Luther King Jr.'s fraternity, to establish a memorial in D.C., and the MLK Jr. National Memorial Project Foundation selected the Tidal Basin as its location and then held the design competition where 906 entrants gave their designs. In 2000, the judges selected the Roma Design Group's plan and fundraising began. In 2006, there was a ceremonial groundbreaking on the site, and in 2009, construction began. Construction didn't actually take that long, as on August 22nd, 2011, the memorial opens to the public. Now, the design of the memorial is intended to evoke the bold and steadfast body of Martin Luther King Jr. emerging like a stone of hope from a mountain of despair. Scrape marks are chiseled onto the sides of all three of those massive rocks, and the memorial is positioned in a straight line with the Lincoln Memorial behind it and the Martin Luther King Jr. statue looking directly ahead to the Jefferson Memorial located across the Tidal Basin. 14 quotes ring the wall behind and to the left and right of him, the earliest from 1955 and the latest from 1968 in a speech he gave 4 days before he was assassinated. The quotes include some of his most famous words, like, "We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice," and "Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that." The quotes touch on morality, justice, unity, and even the war in Vietnam. Now, let me give you my thoughts on it. I can't personally think of anyone more deserving in the past 100 years or so to get a memorial on the National Mall than Martin Luther King. I love who he was, everything that he represents, but I do have to say I'm just a little bit critical of the memorial itself. Now, it's great. I don't want to give the impression that it's not worth visiting or it's not a great memorial to this great man. I just think that it could have been done a bit better. I don't really think the likeness in the sculpture with Martin Luther King is all that great, especially when you compare it to the statues on the Mall of Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson, which in my mind look just like them. The Martin Luther King one doesn't quite have that spinning image quality. I also feel like the symbolism is a bit forced, and for somebody who didn't know much about Martin Luther King Jr. already, they probably wouldn't get the reference of that stone coming out. The stone of hope coming from that mountain of despair, they probably wouldn't get that reference from the I Have a Dream speech. They probably wouldn't really realize that it's even a stone coming out of the mountain. It just doesn't quite have that simplicity that I think really gives a great memorial the real visceral quality that you want in it. I was also personally shocked that none of those 14 quotes chosen were his famous and, in my mind, the most obvious quote, "I Have a Dream." The quote of the stone coming from the mountain of despair comes from the I Have a Dream speech, but the actual speech is not written in quotations. And I love the line. I'm just going to read it here right now. I've listened to that speech dozens of times. I love it. I wish they'd included something along the lines of the beginning of it where he said, "I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be plain and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together." Now, this is just my opinion. Feel free to disagree, but those are my impressions as I walk through. Now, this section of the National Mall is definitely the more quiet, less visited part. And if you're going to go there, you're not going to get nearly the sorts of crowds that you would in other areas of the National Mall, unless you happen to be going during the Cherry Blossom Festival, in which case, good luck, it is going to be packed. Because the MLK Memorial is right on the edge of the Tidal Basin, where all those cherry trees are. So, we're going to walk down from the MLK Memorial, due southeast. You're walking on a path that on your left is the Tidal Basin, beautiful, it's like a lake, and on the right is a bit of forested area with all those cherry blossom trees hanging over you. Watch your head, some of those trees are pretty low. They've been there well over 100 years, and they're not going to be cut down just because you can't notice them, so just pay attention, don't be on your phone or talking too much as you're walking down that path. So you walk along the tidal basin, you walk past the cherry trees, and on your right as you're going is the FDR Memorial. Now, we're not going to talk too much about that, but it's certainly worth stepping into if you want. It's a quiet, intimate memorial with massive stone walls amidst trees with lots of quotes and sculptures and fountains, including the very famous sculpture, The Bread Line, featuring men of the Great Depression waiting in line for food. I walked in there. I spent some time in there. It's definitely not a must-see, but it's worth your time if you have the time to do it. From there, you continue down southeast along the tidal basin. You walk past some baseball fields. Then you walk across this little bridge. It's called the Ohio Drive Bridge, past the George Mason Historical Marker to the Thomas Jefferson Memorial. Now, George Mason was one of the founding fathers. You can walk over and check his historical marker, but it is certainly not a must-see. So now we are at the very last memorial on our trip, the Jefferson Memorial. Now, the Jefferson Memorial is a huge, white, open, circular stone structure built in the style of a Greek temple set directly in front of the tidal basin. Steps lead up to a massive portico entrance held up by 12 Ionic-style columns, and the viewer walks inside a 160-foot-wide open-air pavilion surrounded by 26 additional columns with a large 19-foot-tall statue of Thomas Jefferson. Four floor-to-ceiling excerpts from Jefferson's writings are carved into the walls in the interior of the building, and you can take some time and read them. They're sort of some of his most famous words. So let's briefly talk about the history of this memorial. In 1926, Congress authorized creation of the memorial to Thomas Jefferson. In 1934, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Commission was established. In 1937, after much deliberation, the location on the southern edge of the tidal basin was adopted, due south of the White House and Washington Monument. A year later, on November 17th, 1938, construction finally begins. Now, it was very difficult to build this memorial. I won't go into too much of the detail, but basically, they were putting massive heavy stone on top of silt and fill from the Potomac River, which caused lots of delays and has been an issue for the memorial ever since. If you remember, from the very beginning of this episode, that whole area of land wasn't land until it was filled in. All that area around the tidal basin was dredge and fill from the Potomac River. On November 15th, 1939, President FDR lays the cornerstone for the actual memorial building, and apparently, copies of the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, many of the writings of Jefferson, and one edition of each of the four prominent Washington, D.C. newspapers were placed inside the cornerstone. So, apparently, inside the Jefferson Memorial, there's copies of the Declaration of Independence and U.S. Constitution. Very cool. On April 13th, construction is complete, and the memorial is dedicated on Jefferson's 200th birthday. The dedication is presided over by President FDR. Finally, in 1947, the original plaster statue of Jefferson is replaced with one of bronze, as they couldn't use bronze during World War II due to the restrictions and rationing of the use of metal. Now, the Jefferson Memorial is a large and well-done, fairly impressive, but in general, pretty simple memorial building. If you go there, you're probably going to walk up through the massive portico steps and enter the pavilion inside the Jefferson Memorial, greeted by the huge metal statue of Jefferson himself. When you're inside, it's large, there's very high ceilings, there's massive columns that are opening up to the outdoor air, and there's four large walls with inscriptions of some of his famous writings. Now you go in there, it's pretty quiet, sort of solemn. It's usually not too crowded, like we said, so you can mill around, you can take pictures. Even on the busiest day, not that many people are going to be there. The writings on the wall, I think, are pretty interesting. They discuss democracy, freedom of religion, and slavery. His most famous quote, I would say, is written on there. It's from the Declaration of Independence, when he wrote, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." So that's on the wall. There is an interesting quote about slavery, which gets into some of the controversy with Thomas Jefferson. Part of the quote on the wall is when he wrote, quote, "Commerce between master and slave is despotism. Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free." Now, Jefferson was kind of known to be against slavery and advocated against it in certain ways. Yet, he owned slaves, and during his life, he is thought to have owned over 600 of them. He only ever freed about 10. So I'll leave it at that. It's an interesting contradiction, to say the least. Now, the grounds around the Jefferson Memorial are quite beautiful. There's open space lawns around it, and then the tidal basin in front. You can often see people kind of sitting there and eating their lunch. Shout out to my friends Dave and Lorelei. They actually got married on the lawn right next to the Jefferson Memorial. I believe you can still rent out some of the pavilions and these open areas around the National Mall. They were able to do so. It was very cheap. So if you're interested in hosting an event, potentially a wedding, feel free, go for it. Good job, Dave and Lorelei. So there's also a lot of people kind of hanging out in the area. I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that there's some fishing that people do on the tidal basin. Again, I'm not quite sure if it's allowed, but there were about 5 or 10 people fishing right in front of the Jefferson Memorial. Nobody seemed to be bothering them, so I guess you can do it. And then if you walk north across the bridge just to the right of the Jefferson Memorial, it'll take you back to the Washington Monument, which is a little less than a mile away. So that just about wraps up our discussion here of visiting the National Mall and its history. I certainly hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you take the trip yourself and feel free to use this as your guide. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Educator Podcast, Walking History. Please like, review, subscribe, and share to help support the show and to get updates on each new episode as it comes out. To find more episodes and information about the Educator Podcast, including the Perspectives and How-To series, visit theeducatorpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcast from. I've been your host, Matt Douglas. To find more information about me and my work, please visit lifecoachingsd.com or follow Life Coaching SD on Instagram. This episode was recorded on April 19th, 2021, and all information is accurate to the best of my knowledge. Thanks for listening.